You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. And my name is David Bryan. And that other person on the screen that you're looking at is Leila Steinberg. Probably a name that is familiar to some people if they're in a particular niche, but not widespread. You know, it's interesting if you Wikipedia Leila, well, I don't know, you may feel differently about this. You know, I have this feeling that you are most well known, but you're well known for the things that are least important.
So for sure.
It's really peculiar. So how would you describe yourself? If you're like, you know, what, because you're spoken about as a manager, you're spoken about as rarely spoken about, but should be, as an educator. And then, of course, you're spoken about, you know, sort of as a, when people speak about, you know, two of your most high profile clients, if that's a term you use, and, you know, Tupac and Earl Sweatshirt Tebe. And but how do you describe yourself?
That's a good one. I would say that my identity is definitely, as someone who was always identity challenged growing up, I definitely have my identity tied into motherhood, parenting. It's a huge part of where I found my value and what's really important to me. And then, you know, I entered the arts really from childhood. It was where I did connect and find identity and find community and understand the power and impact of art. And I was a kid that asked questions nonstop. I wanted to know why I was born, why we're here, what is the purpose of life. I remember my earliest memories were nonstop questions.
Did you get any answers to those? Because that would be really helpful.
An interesting journey. But just in terms of how I'm referred to in public spaces and the fact that I haven't done a new bio or really anything in years.
Yeah.
I definitely get tied into my 20s and my entry into the business of music. So when people think about whether I've contributed or not, I'm definitely connected to Tupac. He's been part of my identity. Mm-hmm. And it's been a challenge and also presents an opportunity to talk about culture and society and the trauma and tragedy of that time period. What I participated in terms of the music business and management. But really I did all that because I passionately love education. I like the title of your podcast. I think it's so important to inquire, to have curiosity, to educate oneself, even if it's not through institution, to develop our intellect and do the rigor outside of institutions, in addition to institutions. So I would love if I was identified as an educator, not an artist manager, not even a businesswoman in the arts.
Yeah, but you are, but you, I mean, this thing that you have been doing, well, I remember them as, was it, no, I'm not going to remember that. I know of the organization, which was Aim for the Heart.
Right.
Aim for the, and it, I'm assuming it's still alive and well.
Yes, we have an assembly tomorrow.
And but this is something that you like weekly. Was it weekly assemblies?
I've done weekly assemblies, daily assemblies. I've taken breaks and done a monthly. My 30 years of wanting social emotional learning and emotional literacy to be a huge part of our conversation. And I think things are needs based. And so I needed art in my life, and I needed a place to develop my heart and to look at what role the heart plays. And so anyways, I've been on this journey. I still have the nonprofit. I still do sessions that I lead and have developed a curriculum with two other incredible women. Sure. And they helped me frame my many years of work in a way that's digestible. We just finished the book and hope to publish really soon.
Oh, wow.
So that's been a 30-year journey. And so Tupac and Earl and the many artists that I've worked with all these years really comes from my desire to have deeper conversation, to do educational work, to impart emotional literacy. And the thing about an Earl or a Tupac is that they hit critical mass, they have reach. What we could do overnight if people understood their power, their leadership, would be incredible. And so artists are so powerful that I find myself over and over again in spaces educating artists so that they can really hit numbers.
We haven't spoken a lot. People should know. I know Layla from years ago. We had a friend in common. Larry Bresner was how I met you. Larry was a manager of very high profile actors, comedians, showbiz people. He was also a producer, director, a very funny man. And he spoke about you early on when, I mean, I think I was interviewing Larry and the girls for the school, and Larry talked about you, right? And I was like, whatever, Layla Steinberg. I mean, you know, never hear that name again. And then heard it again, and then heard it again. And, you know, I gotta say, I really think it's worth putting an exclamation point after the Aim for the Heart and the sessions that you were talking about doing for years, because I mean, it's a Herculean feat to do that many, right? Like, I mean, it's every week, right? It was every
for
week.
Sometimes 30, every day. I guess my oldest, oh my gosh.
Yes, once you start that, it's really scary.
38. So I've been doing these sessions for 35 years, pretty consistently all over. And it started as a little incubation process in my living room to create assemblies and have difficult conversations with large groups in schools. And so that's really how it started. Is my kids were little. I wanted to do assemblies. I wanted to bring artists together with deep conversation. We'd have themes. And that very first year, Tupac and Ray Love ended up in the workshop. And I don't know that I knew what I was doing, but back to education. So when I was in Santa Monica, I went to two schools. I went to the alternative school in Santa Monica and Samo High in the afternoon. And then I did advanced placement at SMC. So I would take classes there. And one day, a woman named Peggy Shackleton, she was on the school board in Santa Monica, came and said she was going to do some morning sessions early if any students were interested. She was going to give us books and talk about things. And she announced that, and only seven of us showed up. And she came into my life at such a pivotal point. I think I was 14 or 15. And Siddhartha was the first book she gave us. And she encouraged us to analyze together this story. And until she passed away for so many years, I can't remember, she sent me a book once, twice a year. And so I kind of patterned what I wanted to do around what Peggy did with us. But I wanted to do it with artists because I thought if artists could have deep dialogue, intellectual conversation, debate, their art could go out and we could be the microcosm. I had this vision. And then Tupac joined the group and he really challenged a lot of my visions. So then I also looked at...
He was a kid. He was a...
People always say, how did this kid have such an impact? You were 9 years older than him. What was it? He was raised by a mother who made him read. He had a mother that challenged his thinking. And I wanted to do something with a group of artists that that was very specific. And I also, my mother left when I was younger and moved to the Bay Area. And there is so much activism in the Bay. So I've always straddled LA and the Bay, an artist mother, a criminal defense attorney father. My dad was a juvenile offender in Los Angeles as a kid, became the youngest public defender in the juvenile courts in LA. So I grew up law, activism, artistry, and I wanted to combine them. And that's really how this started in my living room. It was an incubation of dialogue, topics, assemblies, and the marketing and promotion of a new genre of music. And I don't even know that I realized I was marketing and promoting hip hop in its early days through the assemblies. But we began to see very quickly that when you put an artist in front of 2,000 kids in an assembly, you pass out flyers after school, you invite them to your functions, you suddenly have this. But I've always been drawn to music that informs change. I grew up, you know, 1961. My mother was at every musical function, from Bob Dylan to Hendrix to whoever, informed my younger years. So any music that was music based in activism, that I was drawn in.
That was, and at the time, the music really deeply rooted in activism was what we now refer to as hip hop. For sure,
I really understood. I'm from LA. My formative early years were, we migrated 64th and Vermont, La Cienega area, Santa Monica, Malibu. So I've had this relationship to South Central.
You've been upwardly mobile.
But my father was very committed to the neighborhood he grew up in, to the juvenile courts. So I spent a lot of my childhood going to court with my dad. I did homework in the back of the court, summertime. I knew every judge. And I really had a father that talked about equity and equality and that that our institutions were really built to warehouse Black and brown people, and that white kids and white adults had private attorneys more often. And so I looked at race very young. Race has always been a deep part of my journey, my conversation.
Well, it's also you. I mean, you may present, well, you've got a name, Layla Steinberg.
Yes.
You present as a white-ish person, but you're mixed in a variety of ways. Yeah.
We have very mixed family, but and it's so funny. I don't know what to think of all the DNA things, but you grow up identifying and understanding this, and all of a sudden you look at your identity through this lens of whatever the genetics are. And I'm like, oh, I'm 23% Italian. I never knew I had an ounce of Italian, so I don't know. But my mother was born in Mexico, her family from Turkey to Mexico. Came here when she was 9, first language Spanish. My father's family, Polish, Ukrainian, Black kids. And I grew up, if you look at my elementary school, every photo of my class, predominantly Black and brown. So I identified with my neighborhood. I love the Black community as a child, my musical connections in school. And the one way I could feel connected and fit in was I could dance and play sports. And so it was where we forgot who we were, what our families looked like. It was how I built a community of friends that I still have to this day. And
from an early age, I don't mean kid early age, but you saw the need for wisdom of yearning for what, you know, what now fits under the umbrella of social emotional learning, or it was intelligence, right? So why did you give a story for why you thought that was so important? And how does it feel for it to be villainized now that you look around the world? It's like, we don't want any of that social emotional learning. Like, what?
And I think if we look at what's going on right now with the conversations that we have, whether we want to talk about what's happening with Kanye or Kyrie.
Well, I hope to get there. Yes.
We want to talk about what's going on in Iran. We are illiterate. We are culturally illiterate, racially illiterate. And the reason I always bring up emotional literacy, and it's at the core of my root of my work, is that if you get someone's heart, you can take them anywhere. Mm-hmm. And because we're emotionally illiterate, we don't take the time to do the work that would help us have the empathy we need to stop canceling people, to not have conversations. Half the people that take political positions have never done the work to even understand what we're voting for. They're guided by other people's work. And I think that's really heartbreaking, especially because I've seen this and watched it. But I'm looking at how to help young people manage their pain so that they make conscious choices and don't end up caught up. And it's so unbalanced, and the way we treat people of color is so different. There is nowhere that we can understand race more than walking through prison yards or juvenile halls. And because I've spent 34 years in institutions, looking, studying, doing the work, I always come back to emotional education, and everything else follows. And I mean, all of the people that we could identify and look at are hurting. We have so many people in pain, traumatized, angry, that we can't even have the underlying conversations that are needed. And there's some truth to what everyone is saying. I'm always looking at, I am a white woman. Even if my mother is a really brown woman, which she is, even if I have black and brown, I'm a white woman. I have privilege. I have the last name Steinberg. I have lived in privilege even when we didn't have anything. And I've always understood that. I have always had grandparents and parents that reminded me what they sacrificed for me to have the privilege of analysis, even, and to have social commentary and to contribute. And that really, for my grandmother to say it's a privilege to even contemplate social change, somehow stuck with me. And so I felt responsibility. So even in looking at what Kanye was really saying when he was addressing the Jewish community, I always want to look at what is the truth of this pain? What is the underlying issue? And how many other people have said things and have not been held accountable? Why can Eminem say the N-word and Justin Bieber, and we did not cancel them? And so I also want to look at, in bringing these conversations to the table, if we could do it as someone who's emotionally literate, we could have a conversation in a different way. And these are really painful conversations. I have family on both sides of every argument. So I'm always sitting in the middle, like, how can we?
Can you say a little, because you brought up the Kanye thing. Is you know, you've been around that world, the world of hip hop, whatever, for a variety of ways, right? In for years. Is there Is there an issue in that, more specifically in that world? I mean, is anti-Semitism somehow larger there than it is elsewhere?
I think it's hard to frame anti-Semitism in the way that the conversation that I'm hearing is going. I think there's a deep history in the Black and Jewish community. And there's a history of promise and possibility and pain. And there's a lot of work that has been done with both communities together. So I think this could be a whole 2-hour conversation that I don't want to say things that don't allow me to have the longer conversation, because there's so much that needs to be addressed. And because I sit in the middle of this world and I am Jewish and I have Black children and my children are Jewish, if we look at Jewish law, whatever your mother is.
Sure.
So all of these layers of conversation, and then I have children that challenge my thinking, and a father that's forced me to look at justice and equity. And so that's why I'm saying, I think that we need to be able to have the conversation that allows us to hear this pain and not, like, I've worked in Kanye's circle and I've gotten so much love that sometimes I think we take a comment and make and identify somebody as,
yeah, there it is,
anti-Semitic, when that, I don't believe that is the issue at all. I think you have someone yelling out from anger and pain, and it's not fair to direct your issue with three people and throw it out to a whole community. And it happens a lot and no one's exempt. And we keep putting artists on pedestals and iconizing them, and it is not fair. I don't know if we do that in other countries, but we absolutely do it in this country. We put people on pedestals because they can sing and rap and write poetry, and then we want to break them down, which is why I do so much work with artists, because I want them to understand their power. I want us to understand we are accountable for everything that comes out of our mouth. Mm-hmm. I also want us to not cancel people because we're afraid of the deeper conversation that is required. Did that make sense? Did I say that?
Oh, totally. I think that last piece, the idea that the response to anything is, quote, canceling rather than, you know, look, maybe people should be punished for certain things, but the idea that somehow that's the only thing that's required, right? I used to run into this all the time at a school, right? Like, somebody would apply to the school and why are they applying at this weird time of the year? Well, because they did something really stupid at the last place they were at. And, you know, maybe it was really stupid, maybe it wasn't, but sometimes it was really stupid. And the attitude of that school, and frequently the people at New Roads, my school, was like, well, we can't take that kid, look what they did. It's like, wait, that's it? Is that it? The person's done? They've made this one mistake. You can never come back from this mistake. Your life is now over. It's absurd. It's an absurd way for human beings to be.
I mean, I think that that's also where equity and equality come in, because we don't punish people the same. We don't hold people accountable the same. And so when I was talking about emotional literacy, a lot of times people think it's just for ourselves. So I know that I'm angry, let me monitor my anger. I'm hurting, I need to work on these tools. Emotional literacy requires you to be literate with everyone. It requires you to know what's going on with people you love, people you don't know. It requires you to be able to read situations and rooms. We are in a very violent time in a very violent country with people who act out instead of using their intellect. And so the reason I say that we have to get to people's hearts is we have to find a way to help people learn how to think. And it it really works, especially with young people, when you begin to help them put words to feelings, start with the self, but then remove one's whole self-identification and start looking around and looking at who you're in a classroom with, and maybe someone isn't okay today, and to begin to show up for the community, your peers, and teachers have so much power. If teachers, like artists, understood that every time you have 30 minds in the palm of your hands, you can really change the culture of a classroom.
Absolutely.
And I only say that because I've done it over and over again. And speaking of Tebe, you know, I love
her. Speaking of Tebe,
it reminded me of just evidence of the work. Yeah. I mean, it is important because what it did was it gave me an opportunity for my own redemption. Although I'm about to tell you, but I feel like there was a group of us with Tupac that watched him go off a cliff. Mm. We saw it. We talked about it. I stayed.
You talk about it with him?
With just, he was 25 years old and got murdered. What's the responsibility of everyone around him that contributed to everything from his lifestyle, to his behavior, to everything that ended up culminating in his death? And because I was never a threat and not much of a factor in the later years, I always maintained a relationship with Tupac. I stopped doing management work for him around 93. It was too much. It was toxic. I never signed up for what it became. I always looked at Pac's reach and possibility and his heart in those early days when we had a big dream that together we would change education, social justice. We really were a group of young people that saw what we could do and the possibility. I think they're working on trees next door. Let's hope that doesn't get loud.
All right. We'll figure it out.
But anyways, it was a train that got away from all of us, and it was
what does that mean? Oops, wait a second. I think I'm frozen. So let me unfreeze. There we go. So what does that mean? There was a train that got away from.
It means he started out. If we look at Malcolm X and we look at just his transformation and who he was as an activist that woke up a generation and became the symbol of a level of activism. Tupac was a lot like Malcolm in the beginning. He wanted to fight for a cause. He wanted social justice. He wanted things different for the Black community primarily, but he cared about humanity. When he died, his lifestyle was really toxic. He had people around him that were toxic. His behavior changed. I still love Pac, but if we're honest, he wasn't healthy for the Black community in the end of his life. Those 9 months that he was on Suge's label, he was really divided. He really wanted to make a difference, but he was living a lifestyle that informed by hip hop culture, rap music, and this is part of this Kanye conversation. Record executives profited off of violence, off
Absolutely.
Of perpetuating some really unhealthy things. And I watched it and was not able to impact anything. I was not respected enough. I was really convenient when I brought incredible talent to the table, when I developed talent. But as a woman in business, I had a lot of fights in a lot of rooms, and I really saw how unhealthy this industry was for Tupac and what it did to him. And so with Tebe, I saw an opportunity to have an influence, and he was young enough, and my voice was so much stronger that I wanted to see this really brilliant young man live. And the record deals and the money were not as important as saving this young man's life. And I knew, because I was so much older now, that I could have some influence and that I could guide him. And so I welcomed the opportunity, and he welcomed the opportunity to get out of Samoa and didn't plan to keep me around. He was honest with me. It's so funny when I think about it, but I actually met him when he was 13. He was at the Boys and Girls Club. I did my program in Santa Monica at the Boys and Girls Club. Mm-hmm. And my son, Naiku, kept saying that that's the kid that everyone says is so talented. So I went up to him. That's why this is so funny. But I went up to him and said, oh, I heard you are so talented. I do this workshop for artists. And if looks could whatever, he just basically rolled his eyes and looked at me.
Whatever.
Who are you to even think you have anything to offer me? So the funny thing is, a couple years later, when Larry called me, and I could not tell anybody. There's a whole search for him and Free Earl, and I couldn't even tell my kids.
You and me both.
I ended up being able to kind of manipulate him to cooperate with me and my work and my curriculum. We had a deal. I'll come get you, but you got to do a little bit of writing. And so it was an amazing opportunity, because I had never worked with someone on a Zoom through phone calls. So
tell me, but honestly, why did he keep you around? Because you were a ticket out of Samoa.
Yeah, he knew I could help him. I know how to navigate the justice system, facilities, education. He knew I could help take him through graduation. And he also knew that it would be complicated if he ran home and got together with the group that his mom was so frustrated with, because we're not considering her son's health, his mental health.
Right.
Oh, it's an industry.
Totally.
He could make people a whole lot of money.
Right.
And he's not Tyler. Tyler has gone on to make a shit ton of money. He's brilliant. I love Tyler. I think he has his own journey. But
this is Tyler, the creator, in case people don't. Not that they know anything when you say it.
I never planned to actually stay on as his manager. I wanted an opportunity to intercept what I know this industry could do to this young man. And I wanted to be present in his life long enough that that I could help him find his artistry in a way that was sustainable. And so,
why do you think, you were better at it, you were older, but I was going to say, why do you think he... Because some credit to him, he recognized, I'm assuming this is true, he recognized the value you were bringing to him personally, necessarily, right? That
not close. Yeah. I ended up, and that's what I was going to say, when I told him my condition for coming to get him in Samoa was I had to be able to bring my team from the organization, and we had to do workshops there. And he was like, oh my God, they're going to hate you. They don't want what you do here. He was like, I don't know. And I said, our deal is I'll come get you. I'm bringing 9 people with me, and we have to be able to film. And I don't know. He helped make it happen against his will and pushing and fighting. And it was just so funny because he was wrong. We came, we workshopped. He actually took us with him. he built a relationship with some of the community. We got to go to villages that people don't even get to go to. And we workshop the whole time. And it was so powerful. So we had to realize we were all right. Something we were doing is okay. And we're going to keep doing some stuff together, but it's temporary. He let me know, like, I'm not keeping you around in my business. And then slowly, I don't know what happened. I kept showing up and I was like, work with whoever you want. There were times I was like, I don't have to participate in the finance, but I'm showing up. And so now we're family. It's been 10 years. And my daughter, Devaney has really taken over. She's doing business now. I just get to be like Cheryl, a parent.
What do you do with Tupac? With Tebe.
I still oversee a lot of the business decisions. I still know all of his music by heart, his songs. I still do some of the work around contracts, opportunities, but my daughter Devaney does almost everything.
And what about, do you have a, not a say, but a voice? Do you add your voice? Well, so because what you spoke about with Tupac was sort of watching him being pulled in a direction by an industry that, you know, it's just about devouring and not being able to, or not being aware enough to stop it. And is it the same industry? Are those same pulls there? And do you have a voice? Do you get to participate in that conversation?
It's the same industry. No, it's worse. It's actually worse.
That's what I thought.
And yes, that is the one thing I offer is that, and we fight. It's awesome. We actually get to address the issues around the industry. Tebe is a brilliant young man.
Well, that's the other thing. And I don't know Tupac. I'll be never knew Tupac, but I am assuming he was a brilliant person. But the thing I do know about Tebe is, you know, that's a very, very astute human being and always was.
He absolutely was. But he also, like all of us, had a lot of pain and issues and a lot of depression. So I'm older now and I put into practice my theory. Years I talked about emotional literacy and holding conversation, but I wasn't a skilled. So 30 years later, I can sit and mediate large groups that don't agree. I can mediate label artists. I just show up differently and I know a lot more. I was so young then. I thought I knew everything. Now I know I don't know anything, but I can show up and work with you through it. And so our relationship has superseded business. We still do business, but we do it as a community and work together. We've been able to look at the systemic issues around how people do business and don't mix business and family. It's important that you let your mother know what's going on, that you are able to do some family business, that you talk about things. I always felt I worked for Cheryl. No one has more interest in their child than a mother. So she never has an agenda. Her only agenda is the well-being of her child. That's helped me to build a relationship, to let her help guide me in what's best for the family.
That's so funny. You know, I've been trying to get, not because of her, the fact that her son is Tebe, but I've been looking at Tebe, trying to get him to come have a conversation. I remembered, you know, because I bumped into Cheryl on the screen. It's like, oh my God, I want to speak to her about the whole critical. I mean, she actually is somebody who knows something about critical race theory and what it is and what it isn't. And so I'm trying to get to her.
Cheryl is a really important woman. And if you can get her to come and talk, I think.
Oh, I would love to. I would love to. Is she still at UCLA? Do you know?
Yes.
She is, yeah.
LA. And yeah, that's the other thing is that he is so smart and brilliant parents. That's a lot to be in the shadow of his mother's intellect. It is a lot to be in the shadow of activists and revolutionary thinkers. So I also was raised by a lawyer. I think there's something about lawyers' kids. And so I bonded with Tebe in so many different ways. And I really, I'm just so thankful. And the other thing, I have to go vote soon, so we might
We can definitely wind this up. So say what you want to say.
You asked me about anything I'm doing. I completely forgot until just now. And it has to do with Tebe and just looking at technology and the power of technology and how much more advanced some of the kids that are coming in now are and how they think and how they laugh at us as we dwell on certain issues that old folks are arguing over and the kids are like, we've dismissed you guys. I say that to say for over a year, we've been getting hit up for Tebe to do NFTs and be in the metaverse and all this stuff. And so I already struggle with technology. Saw me having trouble on Zoom. I always have someone else doing the work for me. I, you know, started business and had lots of assistants. So, you know, I had to teach myself everything because when I went to college, we had typewriters, you know. So for me, it's been a real crawling wanting to build a relationship with technology. So I ended up being invited. One of my old students now is head of global for Gala Games, Metaverse company, massive company. Eric Schiermeier sold his last company, Zynga, in May for $12.8 billion. So I'm not used
That's
to
junk.
Numbers, right? And tech, the metaverse, I don't think so. So anyways, a month and a half ago, my old student, who's now got a major position at this company, invites me to come to Hawaii because I have a project that I'm involved in. I showed him. He showed Eric, who, you know, Gallus's company, and they wanted to have a conversation about the artist whose stuff I gave them and Tebe and everybody. So I end up in Hawaii on the Big Island with 15 executives from this company. And I was so blown away by just the culture of how they do business. And prior to my even sitting in on meetings, I was like, oh my gosh, they have a naturopathic doctor here. They're getting vitamin drips, all this incredible food, and wow, to live like this, to encourage everyone in the company to work remotely. And every other month they meet in an amazing place. They save all that money on rent and instead have amazing experiences. And then everyone has to go through this training at Gala and they have to do emotional literacy work. I was like, what? Because I've gone and done workshops at William Morris and SoundCloud, but I'm usually introducing the concept.
Yes.
Spaces in education. And here is this company in the metaverse requiring this kind of work before you even get to work with a company. So I was intrigued. Then I began to look at their business model. And I really sat down and explored my own new way of thinking at gaming and the way these kids are in the metaverse playing games with kids all over the world. Mm-hmm. And gaming has now gone into art and music and all of this stuff they're doing now in the metaverse. And I began to look at how exciting it would be to penetrate the gaming and music spaces and work with messaging to a very focused community, just like those incarcerated can't go anywhere. You begin to focus and you start, if you show up, to do really deep work because you can't go anywhere. And the gamers are the same way. You have a very focused audience. They're all over the world. They understand team and sport. They get some of the concepts, but they're doing it in this very weird space.
Right.
Anyway, in a month's time, I've already brought a whole new group of young artists to the space, and every one of them has sold out. It's so absurd. The money is, everything is decentralized. And so I went from being so resistant to now I think I'm a recruiter or something, but I'm so excited about the metaverse now. And I'm talking to kids all over the world through the Discord. And I suddenly see the possibility. And then mm-hmm. I realize every campus has a metaverse club. And we have named Staples crypto.com for a reason. So now I'll be spending this next year really stepping into metaverse spaces and looking at the role education can play in a global way.
Education, you mean emotional education.
I'm not just talking about what I want to do in education. I just see it as the new frontier.
It's definitely the new frontier.
You could have this podcast in the metaverse and you would be reaching a global audience. The capacity now to translate in an instant is insane. So now I'm like, oh my God, I can talk to young people all over the world. I have my agenda, but I'm not even looking just at my agenda. I'm looking at being on the forefront with people who see the possibility of bringing not just gaming, not just music, film, television, but really looking mm-hmm. at the metaverse and the possibilities in education. So yeah,
That's phenomenal. 4 weeks. I think it's one of those things for years I've been, you know, there's so much bashing of kids staring at screens. Right, kids staring at screens. There's so much bashing of it, and the piece of the conversation that so rarely happens is, what is it adding? What is it? What are the possibilities it's opening up? And so I'm so glad to hear that, you know, that they've invited you in. That's great.
It's a trip. I did not want to go. I was kicking and screaming, and here I am. Now I'm telling my grandkids.
There you go.
There you go. I like really in the space all of a sudden, and they're all laughing at me because they're like, "Grandma, what are you talking about?" And I've got the words, the lingo. It took me 6 weeks, and I'm just
fabulous. It's so good.
But this was so great, David. I will definitely. I've got lots of people I think you'll love interviewing from a cross section of lots of spaces.
Really? Can I knock on your door and remind you of that periodically?
Oh, no, I'm going to go see Senate later today. I think he would be really great for you.
So go vote.
Yeah, I'm going to vote. I got to go.
And thank you so much. And so who knows, to be continued. So I'm going to.
Yeah, I'm always down and we can.
If I don't hear from you about somebody else, I'll hit you up.
I got you. Thank you, okay. David.
Thank you. Good to see you.
You too.
Bye.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryant here on LA Talk Radio.